As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Danny Blanchflat joins us right now. Danny, it's fantastic to catch up, and I think we should start there. At the heart of these decisions, what do these decisions mean for everyday Brits, everyday Americans, when Citi are basically saying millions are going to end up unemployed? And the question I've asked, and I think you're perfectly positioned to try and answer it, is higher unemployment a price worth paying to try and get inflation down?
No, well, we have a lot of evidence. I mean, the central bankers forever have said how important inflation is, and they just kind of guessed it. So there's a huge body of literature that I've contributed to, and we look at What's the impact on the country's well-being, if you like, on the wealth of nations, of a 1 percentage point rise in unemployment compared to a 1 percentage point rise in inflation? And the answer is, it's absolutely clear, between 5 and 10 times worse. So a new paper says that the rise in unemployment that they're going to bring about is 10 times worse than the problem they're trying to solve. And you started this thing out. I've been talking a lot about the woman on the Mile End Road omnibus. And what I mean by that is, So the Bank of England sits in the City of London. 1 mile away is the Mile End Road. It's called the Mile End Road because it's a mile from the city, and it's where the two worlds collide. And the question is, what's going on that's going to help the bankers and the city folks that we talk to and the woman riding the bus on the Mile End Road? Right. And the answer, it seems to me, is that we're seeing disaster coming. We're seeing rises in interest rates in the UK when the Bank of England's agents today talk about slowing demand, slowing output. The Bank of England forecasts before the rate rise that there's a high probability of deflation and that output is going to fall over the next 3 years. So what are they trying to do for a problem that's not about demand-driven inflation? And the other thing, John and Tom, I think we really should think about, in a sense, you guys talk about this all the time, but there's so little dissent. The story at the ECB, the story at the Bank of England, the story at the Fed. We've got to do things about inflation. We've got to raise rates. Okay. Potentially, this is going to crash the economies, and it'll all be much worse. Right.
Professor Blanchflower, I stood in the bottom of our building here in New York with Secretary of Treasury Tim Geithner in the heart of the financial crisis, and Geithner brilliantly laid out that they needed to extend the X-axis and use time to heal the wounds. Are these central banks that are panicking because they refuse to send to extend time, to extend the X-axis, to diffuse inflationary impulse?
Well, that's absolutely right, Tom. I mean, the thing that strikes me as very interesting is these central bankers seem to want to respond to every piece of minutiae that comes in every day. Their job is to focus on the forecast horizon, what inflation is going to be, let's say, in 2 years' time. But if that causes all kinds of problems, there's no reason why you shouldn't say, okay, let's let inflation come back to target in 3 years or 4 years. I mean, that's absolutely allowed. And the sensible thing probably to do is to see if this temporary shock dissipates. So you could sit there and say a sensible path would be to sit and wait and watch. But again, where's the dissenting voices? They're all saying the same thing based on zero data. They have no precedent to this. And the danger is that the soft landings are not going to come. I mean, the forecast yesterday from the Fed said output's going to be fine. Unemployment's going to rise just a little bit. And raising rates to 4.5%, no worry. It'll slowly bring inflation down. And that's for Gaga land. That's not going to happen.
Danny, are there any circumstances under which you would argue for raising rates?
Well, of course. Obviously. I mean, absolutely.
So what are the scenarios that would cause you to say it is important to tighten financial conditions?
That's a stupid question in a way. I mean, what we've seen since 2008 is the mother of all shocks. We saw the mother of all shocks, negative shock to output in 2007-8, which you had to counter. If you hadn't counted it, Ben Bernanke said unemployment would have been 25%, so I buy that. So now what we have are giant shocks. I mean, a giant shock from the COVID and from the war. We don't know how it's going to recover. So why would I want to punch the labor market and punch demand before I really know what's coming? I mean, it's as if they know what's coming because they clearly don't. So under these circumstances, supply-driven shock that essentially is going to drop out, my guess in the United States and in the UK, we'll see very low inflation by June as those big numbers, one-off big numbers that we saw, dropped out. So I would have not been voting for rate rises because of the large negative shock. And the debate over the last decade is about the scale of that negative shock.
Danny, it may be a stupid question, and yet some people might be wondering that because they're taking a look at CPI where it is and saying, why wouldn't you want to raise rates? From your perspective, what data point would you be watching to prove your point every week?
Okay, so let's just go with the claims that the Fed has made and the claim that I make. So what you got was a couple of once-off events, which are basically driving the base effects. You've had inflation of 0 and 0.1 in the last 2 months. If you just take 2012 to 2019 and you impose those inflation shocks over the next 8 months, inflation gets to 1 by about June. If you go back to 2008, same date, July 2008, inflation was 5.6%. It was -2 a year later. So the question is, everything's being driven by the base effect. So I would be watching and waiting.
Danny Blanchflat, thank you, sir.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Our guest is so important on what to do with your assets, your money forward. Lisa, help me here with the data check. So much going on. Equities give me a mixed story. The VIX went out above 30 and pulled right back into 27.68, maybe a more quiescent response. The Dow just still above 30,000, didn't get to the 29,000 level. Lisa, what do you see in bonds this morning?
Well, what you're seeing is a front end that just won't quit, right? 4.11% on that two-year yield, and I think that's really important. Also, though, in the currency space, and this sort of goes to the theme that we've been talking about over the first 2 hours of the show, how do other central banks respond to this? The Swiss National Bank raised rates by 75 basis points, officially left the negative yield regime, which had been an eight-year regime, and their currency is weakening the most since 2015. What is the path ahead in this currency war to get a stronger currency at a time when nobody wants anything other than the dollar?
For those keeping score at home, let's be clear. The Swiss went one way. The Japanese went another way. Maybe that's called a currency war, Lisa?
I mean, and a very different one than the ones that we're used to over the past couple
different.
Of decades.
That's really, really important. As Jeff, you said earlier with BNY Mellon, it's asymmetric, to say the least. We need to solve the carnage in your portfolio. Lisa Shallett with us, Chief Investment Officer, Morgan Stanley Wealth Management, and we readjust this morning. Are we rebalancing, Lisa? Are we readjusting? What are we doing amid the carnage?
Well, look, our advice to our clients is certainly that we should be rebalancing here. You know, what we have said is this is a time for active risk management. And what we mean by that is taking a maximum level of diversification. That means diversification by sectors, diversification by technical factors, diversification, by region. I know it's not popular right now,
right.
To speak about, American investors owning non-U.S. stocks given relative outperformance of the last decade. But we think that what's going on in the currency markets is material and that this divergence ultimately will mean revert and that there is going to be some catch up. So we're recommending, maximum active management, diversification,
right.
and things of that nature.
I really look forward to speaking to you because I want to talk about this strange word scale. And I'm going to go back to the great Peter Lynch at Fidelity, who got angry one day and he said, look, I care about your 47th stock pick, not your number one stock pick. There seems to be so little to choose from, Lisa, a la Mike Wilson. How do you get scale or diversification within U.S. equities now if you've only got so many good ideas?
Well, I actually I might push back on that. I think that, underneath the surface of the S&P 500 index and even the NASDAQ indices, we're finding real opportunities. There has been carnage in this market. We know that in small and mid-cap land, there's been carnage. We know that there's a host of sectors that have sold off aggressively, including things like home builders, again, contrarian perhaps, but where, a lot of the bad news or likely news is discounted. And so we do think that there, are things to accumulate out there if you are willing to do the fundamental work. I mean, I think one of the challenges for a lot of investors is the last 13 years have been dominated by a handful of stocks in the U.S. with a growth orientation in the tech and communication sector. And people didn't have to do much work because they could just buy the index and get the job done. This is going to require homework navigating in these markets. And this is when active managers actually for good or for bad, earn their fees. And, we think that is the place to be.
Does that mean, Lisa, that you think the headline figure for the S&P, for example, could trade sideways for years?
I do. I am, more in that camp. I mean, I think that one of the things that has continued to surprise me is the extent to which equity investors have been willing to hold the levels of forward multiples that we're holding in the face of decade high interest rates. We know mathematically and fundamentally that the movement in interest rates higher should equate to lower price earnings ratios. Yes, have we pressed down a bit from where we are in January as the Fed funds has gone, from zero to, three? Yes, we have some. But that we're also in the camp that the current figures in terms of estimates for forward consensus earnings estimates for 2022 full year and then 2023 probably remain too high, especially if we're in this debate about, recession, no recession. And so while the current pricing in markets at 3,800 and change may suggest, a sub 17 times forward multiple, if you adjust those earnings down, we might be back at 17 and a half, 18 times forward. And so this market has more work to do in terms of, quote unquote, getting real.
So who is going to be the leadership? And I ask this because it sounds like in your scenario, big tech cannot be it anymore.
Correct. I think big tech is going to have to consolidate, and I think those valuations are going to have to come in. And I think that they're going to have the come to Jesus moment, which says, yes, these are great companies, but they are no longer great stocks because everyone knows the stories and expectations are extraordinarily high. You know, the reality is that they do operate in the whole big wide world, yeah. Global world. The global world is slowing. The U.S. dollar is a material headwind, and inflation and cost pressures are realities for them as well. So new leadership, you know, from where we sit, is likely to come from different areas, areas like healthcare, areas like energy, industrials that may benefit from some of the infrastructure and capital spending that we think is going to occur over the next couple of years.
Lisa, are we at a point, and I'm thinking of Andrew Mellon in the 1930s on transactions in combinations. Are we at a point where the zombies roll up? I mean, we finally at a point where the real interest rate market, which was the gift the zombies had for 17 years, whatever the number is this the point where the zombies end?
I love what you're saying, Tom, because I do think that that is going to be the next phase here, where the cost of capital does start to pinch. I do think that those who have, you know, strategic capital to deploy, you know, are going to be able to go out and acquire some capabilities. At the same time, I think some of those zombies are going to go by the wayside. You know, starve from not being able to get financing.
Got to leave it there. Lisa Shallot, thank you so much. Terrific brief there on actually what to do with your capital with Morgan Stanley Wealth Management. It is a joy, and how did we know it was an historic day of Japanese intervention, Bank of England action, to have Abby Joseph Cohen with us, professor at Columbia Business School, a modest career at Goldman Sachs as well. Abby, thank you so much for joining us here to keep us informed on the underlying finance and equations, the mathematics of these equity markets. Abby Joseph Cohen, suddenly the Sharpe ratio matters. I guess beta matters again, but outside of beta, we've got the risk-free rate, and it has returned with a vengeance. Are we revisiting the Sharpe ratio? Are we back to the articles you wrote for the CFA years ago?
Tom, wonderful question. And I'm going to respond by giving a bit of a prologue, which is that many models are broken, have been broken during this period of time, because they typically respond to cyclical phenomenon. For example, your question to Michael before about the Phillips curve. And the reality is that there are so many structural changes in the economy and the markets as well, that a lot of those models simply have not applied. Some of them are coming back in force. The Phillips curve, for example, had no way in its model to reflect the fact that there was a pandemic, that we have had this generational shift in labor force participation, by which I mean the baby boomers are now stepping out of the labor force. And the other thing, of course, is that we have had a four-year deceleration, if you will, in terms of immigrants coming into the United States. And over the prior decade, immigrants filled 60 to 65% of the increase in employment in the United States. So there are a lot of things that are different. Within the market itself, a lot of the models haven't applied for a while. Keep in mind this weird 20 to 30 year period in which interest rates and inflation were extraordinarily low. And to your point, real rates reached negative levels, something we had never seen before. I, for one, now I'm answering your question, I'm happy to see that the Fed is now focused on making sure that real rates, real yields are in fact positive. And does the market believe them? And the reality is that we now have a flat to inverted yield curve, which suggests to me that bond investors, at least, are giving the Fed credence and credibility in terms of believing that the Fed policy will have efficacy.
Abby, are you saying that stock markets are not accurately reflecting the fact that inflation would be higher and would remain higher even after this cycle collapse if the Fed were not to keep rates at a much higher level than they had been?
Another very good question. Let me just talk about what happened yesterday in response. And that is the equity market, didn't know what to do. First it was up, then it was down, then it was up, then it was down big time. There was really erratic behavior because, to your point, Lisa, equity investors are really confused because there is this yin yang between inflation and higher yields versus will the economy and earnings continue to grow? And I think we're now at a point where, given the significant rises in interest rates and yields across the yield curve since the beginning of the year, the equity market is now focused much less on inflation and yields than it is on earnings. And there's a lot of confusion. Investors are not sure how this is going to play out for the rest of the year, let alone for 2023. We see, for example, that there are ongoing adjustments to the consensus earnings forecast. But let me point out, we are starting at record profit margins.
Right.
It's not as if profit margins and ROE were low. ROE for the S&P 500 is in excess of 20%. So if there is, in fact, ongoing profit margin squeeze, I think the impact overall is not dramatic. The impact, however, in individual sectors may be significant.
Do you see the possibility of a lost decade, Abby, given the fact that we're trying to readjust and renormalize rates, renormalize some of the financialization of the economy?
You mean a lost decade in the
profits, in GDP, in a lot of things that people harken back to the 70s about?
Sure. I mean, if you look at the valuation of the U.S. equity market and some other markets as well, at the end of 2021, they were at record high levels in terms of where we were on percentiles. Almost every valuation model was between the 95th and 99th percentile, indicating, in my view, overvaluation. Unless you believe that the dream scenario of extremely low interest rates and strong profit growth would continue uninterrupted. So where are we now? The valuations are roughly at average levels. S&P 500 PE, for example, is about 16 times earnings. And given where we are, even with a rise in interest rates, that's not a bad place to be. So when we talk about the lost decade, let's talk about two different phases. Number one, we've now had a 20% correction in share prices from record high levels and record high valuations. Can we get back that 20%? I don't think that happens over the next several months. Over the next few quarters, I think the economy will slow, earnings growth will slow, but I think it's possible that we could see higher equity prices. I kind of peg that along the same lines of the growth in earnings, which is probably, why don't we call it 5 to 10% over the next few months.
Abby, a few years ago, you wrote an iconic paper for the CFA Institute. You mentioned an old strategist I used to talk to named Aristotle. Aristotle never saw a bond market with yield up, price down, and the losses that we've seen over the last year and a half. How do bond investors recover given this historic carnage?
The damage clearly has been much more dramatic in the bond market, and in some ways, the overvaluation in bonds was much more extreme. We had central banks around the world who kept interest rates nominally extremely low levels, and real yields were low in many countries. You know, two-thirds of major economies, not the U.S., but two-thirds of major economies had negative real yields. So the damage that we've seen in the bond market, I think it was expected. When we look at government bonds, it's one thing. The damage in the credit markets is something that we've not yet seen fully rolled forward because a lot of those are illiquid securities. And I think we're going to see more damage ahead. But for the average investor who is willing to buy, for example, an individual bond and now can get a 3 or 4% yield, depending upon the maturity they're willing to take on, that is something that is one of the best opportunities in 20 years.
Very good. Are you liking teaching, Abby? I mean, this is a whole different act for you. You're surviving Columbia. Do you throw chalk at people?
I do not throw chalk because we use whiteboards. So
okay.
If I'm going to throw anything, it's going to be a marker. So I'm loving it, Tom. It's a great opportunity for me to be involved in the next generation.
Wonderful. You look tanned and rested. Thank you so much. Abby Joseph-Cohen, professor at Columbia Business School.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is a week of, well, Lisa, traffic in Midtown Manhattan.
Yeah.
How about that traffic that we all see with thousands descending for the United Nations General Assembly meetings and much more? Far more importantly, there's a migration in October to the meetings of the International Monetary Fund in Washington. Someone who knows the schedule is Sergei Nikolaichuk, Deputy Governor of the National Bank of Ukraine, and we're honored that he could join us today amid a terrible, terrible war. I need to go, first of all, to a simple anecdote of your Kyiv. You're educated in Kyiv. You have seen the transformation over 20 years. How does Kyiv recover back to what you knew when you were younger? How do you see that happening?
Actually, Kyiv changed dramatically for the last 20 years. Before the war, it looked like a normal European city, capital of the European country. So you was able to enjoy the restaurants, clubs, shopping malls, and so on. Definitely changed were sizable since the beginning of the war. So Kyiv was completely empty in March, April. Mm-hmm. So nowadays the life is recovering.
Coming back,
yeah. Still you feel the consequences of the war on each step.
Gorgieva of the International Monetary Fund has a few distractions away from your war. Mm-hmm. What is your unique message to the International Monetary Fund as you cry for help? What is the distinction, you say, versus all the other headaches they have around the world?
Definitely Ukraine needs the support from the International Monetary Fund. So we are very grateful for the International Monetary Fund for providing us $1.4 billion under the RFI at the beginning of the war. But so far we need more, and we are ready to engage into the full-fledged program. So mainly we focus our efforts in order to launch the EFF program of the large scale, and the authorities are fully functional and ready to negotiate and to discuss the policies in order to launch such type of program.
Sergey, we've been talking a lot about central bank rate decisions over the past week, and we've gotten a lot of them in the past 24 hours. You recently kept the rate unchanged. How do we even have monetary policy and try to keep a normal sense of monetary transmission in the face of a war, in the face of such incredible disruption in day-to-day commerce that it becomes sort of not really a main feature?
Yeah, definitely. Our approach to the monetary policy changed dramatically since the beginning of the war. Before the war, we relied on the inflation targeting framework, very similar to many other central banks all around the world. But at the beginning of the war, we moved to another setup. We started to rely heavily on the stability of the exchange rate. We supported our actions on a fixed market with tough capital controls, and after some period of adjustment, so when we kept the interest rate stable at 10% in early June, so we raised it to 25% in order to help ourselves to maintain the stability of the exchange rate. And our last two monetary decisions were to keep this interest rate at 25%. At the same time, so as you rightly mentioned, so we struggled to improve the monetary transmission, which was not perfect before the war, and definitely it is even worse since the beginning of the war. But so far, we see that our decisions, so they are translated into the banking rates more or less as we expected, and we hope that tighter monetary conditions will help us to maintain the stable exchange rate.
What will it take on the fiscal side? And you were talking about the IMF aid and how much you might potentially need. How much would you need and how long would it take overall to rebuild the economy in a way where you could go back to something more akin to normalcy?
Okay, so frankly speaking, the losses from the war are tremendous. So that relates both to the current situation when we have a huge budget gap, which we have to help to finance from the central bank side. And actually this year we already provided more than $10 billion to the government in order to support the essential needs, financing the essential needs. And at the same time, that puts sizable pressure on the fixed market. Yeah.
We're running out of time here, Governor, and so I've got to keep this short and abrupt, and I'm being rude in doing that. Ukraine has had a courageous 2 weeks. The news flow has been extraordinarily good in the military front. What do you need from the allies right now? What do you need from Mr. Biden and the West right now?
Definitely, we need the continuation of the support both on military front and also continuation of financial aid. So we prove to the whole world that we have we may win, and we hope that with the continuation of the support from the democratic world, we will achieve the victory as soon as possible.
Thank you so much for joining us at Bloomberg today, Sergey Nikolaychuk of the National Bank of Ukraine here. Among this week of disunited nations. Really an extraordinary set of meetings, Lisa. I'm going to call it post-pandemic. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.